This election night, C-SPAN delivers something different. Not just the presidential race, but the state races that will decide the balance of power in Congress. Follow C-SPAN Tuesday, November 5th on TV, online, or on the free C-SPAN Now video app.
The Rewind with Henry McKean. This is News Talk.
You're very welcome to The Rewind with me, Henry McKean, where we take a nostalgic look back on a year. Today, we're going back to the 1980s. The year is 1984. Over the next hour, we will be chatting to the game changers from 84, with movies like Ghostbusters and Gremlins. Music television comes to Ireland with Vincent Hanley and MTUSA. A Dunn Stores worker refuses to handle South African goods, eventually helping to bring down apartheid. And the 1984 Olympic Games in LA brings huge Irish pride as John Tracy wins silver in the marathon. But first, Ethiopia is hit by famine and civil war. A Michael Burke BBC report pushed Sir Bob Geldof into starting up Band-Aid, raising millions for famine relief. Michael Burke's report shocked the globe. It was broadcast by 450 TV stations worldwide. Viral before we knew what viral was. It immediately had an impact. Here is a clip from Michael Burke's report. The original is over 6 minutes long, with sparse, powerful commentary. Perhaps the most influential in TV reporting ever.
This mother and the baby she bore 2 months ago, wrapped together in death. As body after body was brought down, the grief became almost tangible. By quorum standards, it wasn't a bad night, 37 dead. Tomorrow, there would be more. The day after, more still. Once the bureaucracy of death is over, the bodies are picked up to be carried back to the villages they left in hope such a little time ago. A tragedy bigger than anybody seems to realise, getting worse every day.
Michael Burke, thank you so much for joining me. Going back 40 years since you did that report on the Ethiopian famine, and you write about it in your book, The Road Taken. Bring us back to that time.
Well, it's difficult. It's four decades, and the past is a different country, isn't it? Africa was in a very bad state for two reasons. One, climatic. There was drought and hunger and so on, but it was compounded by any number of civil wars across the continent, particularly in the Horn of Africa and Ethiopia, where there were two civil wars going on simultaneously. And as always in these cases of extreme hunger and natural disaster, it isn't just the climate; it's mostly man at the root of the whole thing. And as a journalist, by a combination of mostly good fortune and other reasons, we ended up being first on the scene of something quite widespread and devastating.
And it really was widespread and devastating. And you write about how difficult it was to actually get into that area of Ethiopia, to get past all the red tape, to get past the bureaucracy, and get into a plane and persuade and cajole. And then I understand you almost didn't land there, and the story might never have been told.
There was a monster in charge of Ethiopia at the time, a dictator called Haile Mariam Mengistu, and he was celebrating the 10th anniversary of the overthrow and murder of the old emperor Haile Selassie, and stopped people, not just journalists, but also a lot of aid workers from leaving the capital because they all had to concentrate on his celebrations. And at that time, the rains failed yet again, and a situation that had been in crisis tipped over into catastrophe. We were lucky. The cameraman I was working with was a wonderful old rogue called Mohammed Amin. Did a kind of deal with an agent, had a twin otter plane, and we got up country. We were going to land in a place called Lalibela, which is famous because it's got absolutely marvelous churches carved out of the living rock, and we were going to land there. But at the last moment, the plane diverted, which was a really good thing because we hadn't realised that the place had been taken over by the rebels. And if we'd have landed there, we'd have either been killed or marched overland to Sudan. And that would have been the end of us or the end of our coverage of the story. So,
yeah. And what you saw in that camp at that time, in a way, it changed everything, perhaps the biggest story of your career. And it really changed people's hearts and opened people's hearts. And obviously it led to huge, massive outpourings of emotion and fundraising.
I knew we'd stumbled on something that was that important doesn't begin to describe it, does it? It was a human catastrophe on a major scale. That was obvious. What wasn't quite so obvious is that, you know, we were there, we could see it, smell it, touch people. You know, there were people trying to give us their children and babies and so on. I mean, the personal experience had obvious and immediate and enormous experience on us personally because we were experiencing it at first hand. What wasn't so predictable. And what worried me at the time was that was all very well, but how would that be communicated to people who were seeing it at several removes in the comfort of their living rooms, watching it on a screen, while they're, having a beer or a coffee or, yes. or something, it was an anxiety, but also I couldn't see that people's reactions at that remove would be the same, or certainly not as intense as our own reactions were, being on the spot and experiencing it firsthand.
Because you do talk about that, the fact that putting words to pictures what you saw and what you described when editors saw it around the globe. I mean, it was shown on over 450 TV stations. It was viral before it went viral. People really were so upset, from the children to the elderly to the cynical news editors. It really did go global, watched by the whole globe, and then obviously leading to Sir Bob Geldof seeing it, starting Band-Aid, selling 50 million copies, raising millions and millions and millions, and then again obviously Live Aid in 85, watched by the whole globe, 2 billion, bigger than anything perhaps that we could all imagine. When we look back at that, and when we look back at that legacy, I did get to visit Ethiopia a few years ago, and it still has issues, and I know you've been back too. What do you think the legacy is of your report 40 years ago?
Oh, well, it's difficult to say. Well, the immediate legacy, well, the report is one thing, the response is another. The immediate, you can divide it into two, really. The immediate legacy was what has been described as the biggest rescue operation in history. And nobody really knows how many lives were saved, not just by Band-Aid and Live Aid, though that was important, but also because under public pressure, the aid policies of the European Union, the United Kingdom, the United States was changed, which probably had more of an actual impact on the ground at the time. So there was the immediate rescue operation and all that sort of stuff. One of the other legacies, I don't know, there's lots of things I don't know about it. One is, why was there that reaction at that particular time when it had never happened before and actually hasn't happened in the same way since?
No.
I mean, Sudan at the moment is almost as bad as Ethiopia was then, but you don't even hear a word about it on the news or in newspapers most of the time. There is that kind of why. The other legacy, thanks I think so much to Geldof, was that people were engaged. For the first time, people in the first time, on that scale anyway, people in the first world not only felt sorry for or even responsible for the awful sufferings of some people in the third world, but actually felt they could do something about it, that their contributions, however small, were actually making a difference. And I think that enablement that the extraordinarily vivid character of Geldof managed to create was a legacy that continues to this day with telethons and comet reliefs and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Now, has it made any difference in the long run? Well, you've got to ask a few questions about the efficacy of development aid, you know, really deep and serious questions. You know, if it was a matter of money, trillions have been spent on aid to Africa. If it was a matter of money, there wouldn't be a problem at all. You know, have things changed radically? No, they haven't. You know, Africa is still a patchwork of basket case countries run by dictators with corruption and an entire continent that is coming adrift from the rest of the world in terms of its prosperity and hunger and so on. And also, you've got to factor in a few more considerations, like, you know, when 40 years ago the population of Ethiopia was around 40 million. Mm-hmm. Today, the population of Ethiopia is somewhere in the region of 130 million. In other words, it's tripled since then, creating lots of problems. You know, the band also they've got another set of wars or semi wars. So you know, the situation hasn't been solved in the long term. But at the time, you know, rather like a band-aid, you can't argue about a million lives being saved. The most a journalist can really say is that people can't say they didn't know.
Michael Buck, thank you so much for speaking to News Talk.
Pleasure.
Up next on The Rewind, 1984, John Tracy wins silver at the LA Olympics in the marathon.
Taking you back in time. The Rewind with Henry McKean. This is News Talk.
John Tracy is 100 metres to go. In the past, Ireland have won bronze medals. John Caldwell, Freddie Gilroy, Sox Byrne, Jim McCourtney, Russell. They've won golds. Pat O'Callaghan twice. Bob Chisholm, Ron Delaney. They've won silvers with John McNally. Fred Teague, Wilkinson. And for the 13th time, an Irish medal goes to John Tracy. The crowd stand to the Irishman from Villierstown in Waterford. The little man with a great heart from County Waterford has done it.
The year is 1984, 40 years ago, four decades. And we have a very special guest in studio here today beside me, John Tracy. You're very welcome to the programme.
Nice to be with you, Henry.
You know, going back to that time, going all the way back to that very, very special year for the country and for you, and, you know, people, I'm guessing, still stop you in the street to say hello all these years later in the supermarket after you won that silver medal in the marathon in LA. What do people say to you even now, 40 years on?
Well, they're all bald or grey. they're all over 50 anyway to start with.
Yeah, yeah.
And they usually tell me how they watched the race. And in many cases, they had watched it with their father or their mother, and it means something for them, right? Because the father or mother are now passed, but they have that fantastic memory with them, sharing the watching the marathon and watching my joy and Ireland's silver medal with them. So it's something special in a lot of people's lives. But
yes,
they do remember it because it sticks out, because it was something special at the time.
And that's the thing, your joy, your medal is everyone's medal in a way. You have to share that moment. And even having you in right now, sitting from across you, you know, I feel special from just being around you. And actually, the first time I met you, believe it or not, was over in LA at the Special Olympics in 2015, in the exact same spot where you ran in. This was the closing ceremony. You ran in all those years earlier. And when you go back there, and you are actually flying back to America in the coming days. When you go back, do the memories flood back?
They do, yeah. And obviously, Los Angeles was a very happy place for me. And it was somewhere where I always ran well. But that Coliseum and running into that Coliseum with Charlie Spedding on my shoulder was really a kind of a very special moment. And the Coliseum was buzzing that night. It was the night of the closing ceremony. There was 90,000 people in the Coliseum. And it was just really, really special. And having to fight with Charlie over the last lap to get the silver medal, that was obviously all part of it as well. But it's a very, very happy hunting ground for me, the Coliseum.
Because you sacrificed so much and you beat Spedding by seconds. Was it seconds?
How? 3 seconds.
3 seconds, that's all it was. And then obviously Carlos Lopez was there getting the gold. For you going back and making that sacrifice, because I understand you moved your young family back to the States to try and, you know, get better and better, and then working with doctors to figure out, actually, hang on a second, John Tracy is better at marathons yes. than the 10,000 metres. And then realising that it was the marathon that your body was built for. Tell us about that time and, I suppose, gambling it all.
Well, yeah, I think you come to stages in life where if things are not going well for you, there's only one thing to do, change. The same doesn't work.
Yes.
You need to change. So I changed and I uprooted our family. We had a house in Dundrum. We uprooted that and went back to Rhode Island.
And you had a good job in the trade board.
I had a good job in the trade board. So it was time to it was time to leave that behind as well. And because I was, as an athlete, I was unfulfilled.
Yeah.
And I still knew I had the ability. I had this knowledge that I had this ability, but I wasn't able to manifest itself because I was trying to do too many things in my life. So what I was trying to do is go back to a training base, go back and train with people, go back to an environment that I was comfortable with, and kind of leave the job behind and just hope to survive the year. that was the idea.
At Moscow, the heat got to you 4 years earlier, training in that heat and becoming comfortable in that heat and everything falling into place from luck to a sponsor. And, you know, this is an example of why sponsorship is important, because I have a pair of New Balance runners, even to this day.
Yeah.
And 40 years later, after New Balance gave you some money, it meant that you could concentrate on the running.
That's right. That's right. And that was really kind of a key moment for me as well, because we had... Fionnuala and myself had a daughter, Kiva, and, you know, so we were obviously trying to live. And what it really did mean was I didn't have to race to make money anymore.
Yes.
So I could really kind of plan my training properly, plan my racing properly, and not have to worry about a monthly check coming in, because the monthly check came in every month for New Balance.
You know, you have that unique style when it comes to running, and you went over the line and you got that silver. And I know that people talk about Jimmy McGee and almost like as if he won the silver. And he talks about all the other Olympic medalists. When did you realize, hang on, I've hit the jackpot? When did you realize this perhaps was bigger than you?
We did the medal presentation. I quietly disappeared and we sat waiting for a bus at the curbside for about half an hour.
And you were stiff, weren't you?
I was stiff, yeah. But we did it. And I was anxious to go back to the village to start eating. And I didn't really kind of... There was a bit of fuss in Rhode Island when I went back there, because I went back there to collect the family, as they say.
Yeah.
So I was there for 3 or 4 days, and then I went to Ireland, and then there was parades.
All hell broke loose.
But, you know, it was a time when Ireland didn't have a huge amount to celebrate and on the sporting field, and it was a huge deal. And I probably didn't realise it at the time. How big a deal it was. But, you know, we hadn't won any medals at that Olympic Games until the silver medal came along on the last day. So it was something to celebrate, definitely. And the Irish people love their track and field, as we saw this year. You know, they do love their track and field. And they do appreciate what it is, because track and field, we compete against the very best in the world, 200 countries.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really global sport. And little Ireland did very well and continue to do very well.
And when you look now, 40 years later, how well we did in the Olympics just there in Paris, and we're getting ready for LA, will you be going back to LA in 4 years' time?
I'll have to go back to LA in 4 years' time. Yeah. I went to Paris, and my only regret about Paris was I didn't go for long enough. But
you were there.
I was there, but I really enjoyed being a spectator. It was my first Olympic Games, Paris was, not being an athlete and not being an official.
Of course, so you weren't an administrator, you could just enjoy it.
I could enjoy it. It was great. I loved every minute of it.
I'm very jealous. I didn't get over. I'm to my grave. It's my biggest regrets of the year was I was in France on holiday and I was watching it with French people on a campsite, but I wasn't actually at the Olympics and it's eating me up inside. And, you know, like that, everybody wants to touch the winners. And that homecoming, the late Charlie Bird, I did get to hear some of that footage. And the crowds, what was that like coming home?
I didn't like any of that fuss.
You didn't like the fuss?
No, the last thing in the world I wanted was any fuss, to be quite honest. Mm. But it was lovely at the same time. We appreciated it at the time. Fionnuala and myself did appreciate it. And it was really nice. And I put up with it I did it for two or three days and then I just wanted to get away from it.
You just wanted to disappear. And the thing is, looking back on it 40 years later, it's always going to be a part of you. Your family, you know, will always be there. You know, where is the medal now?
The medal is at home.
It's at home?
It's at home, absolutely. Yeah. It should be at home because if someone wants to come into the house and see the medal.
And is it on display?
It is on display.
But you've got Aircom Phone Watch, so it's safe.
Yes.
Or you've got some sort of security. I think it's now just called Phone Watch. And I understand people say, you know, and you've said it too, winning the silver, is it joy? Is it relief? Is it something else?
Well, it's relief first. Mm-hmm. That's the first feeling when you cross the line. Yeah. Feel, right? And then the joy.
And then the joy.
Then the joy. And and there's something special about being with your peers after a race, because your peers come up and congratulate you. And that's like you really kind of enjoy that.
Yeah.
And this really is something special. And all the guys that I had raced against for 10, 15 years, you know, they're coming up to congratulate you.
And that's great because there's a competitiveness and they're also friends. And I understand in like 95 when you retired, they came together again to say goodbye.
Yeah, they did. We had Eamon Coughlin there and Gerry Kieran and the late Gerry and Steve Cram came over.
Wow.
And the three medalists, obviously Spedding, Charlie came over, Carlos Lopez came over. So it was, some of the problems, Richard Mulligan came, you know,
it was a lovely send off.
It was a lovely send off. Yeah. And it was really kind of appreciated by myself. And I really enjoyed it. And it was very special for me because we did it in Waterford City, where it all started in 1970. And we finished it in Waterford City as well.
Absolutely beautiful. And I just hope, John Tracy, people continue to stop you in the supermarket and congratulate you 40 years on. Silver in the marathon at the LA Olympics in 1984. Thank you so much for bringing us back to that time, John Tracy. This is The Rewind, back after this.
Taking you back in time. The Rewind with Henry McKean. This is News Talk.
And you're very welcome back to The Rewind. It's 1984 and I'm Henry McKean. Now, the Dunstall strike began in July 84 when a 21-year-old checkout operator, Mary Manning, was suspended because she refused to handle South African grapefruit. And nine of her colleagues walked out in support of her that day, beginning a strike that would last for nearly 3 years. Here is a clip from Henry Street in 84, outside Dunn's.
So we had got a union instruction not to handle South African goods. And when we all decided, the girls were out on strike here now, and some of the girls who were in working decided that we wouldn't handle the goods. And when I refused to handle them, the rest of the girls had been refusing to handle them as well, but there's a man dressed behind my register when I actually refused. And I was brought up to the office and told I was given a few minutes to think about what I was after doing. And I didn't change my mind. And then they suspended me then indefinitely until I came back in and handled the goods.
A clip from 1984 as Dunstall's shop workers refused to handle South African goods. And here is Mary Manning joining us now.
So we really didn't know anything about apartheid at the time, so we had to go around and check to see what was in the store that was from South Africa. And then we started to refuse to sell them. And a woman came up to me with two grapefruit in her basket, and I just told her I couldn't sell them. And she was fine. She didn't mind. But there was a manager standing behind me, and she told me to close off my register and brought myself and Karen, who was the shop steward at the time, up to the office. Separated us and gave me 5 minutes to reconsider what I did. And then once I said I was going to continue, they suspended me indefinitely.
Here we are 40 years on, and the fact that Ireland eventually did listen to you, the nation, the government listened to you. We were the first country to ban produce, the first Western country. And, you know, you go on to meeting Nelson Mandela in 1990 and actually making a huge change in history just by not touching these grapefruit.
When the strike started, we knew little, if nothing at all, about what was happening in South Africa and about apartheid. It started off really as a kind of an up yours for Duns, because they wouldn't sit down with us for a meeting that we wanted to have with them about other issues in the store. So initially, all we wanted to do was the right to refuse to handle the goods. It was only after we were standing out in the picket line that we to learn what was actually happening in South Africa, and it became more than just a piece of paper to us. It became something that we really believed in and that we couldn't go back in to handle the goods. So for us to achieve the government changing the law was a huge achievement for us, but wasn't what we had set out initially to do. So it made it even better, I suppose.
Dunn's worker, Mary Manning there, who refused to touch South African goods, in a way, she helped bring down apartheid just a little.
The Rewind with Henry McKean.
This is The Rewind with me, Henry McKean. We are celebrating the year 1984, going back 40 years. And now we're going to talk about music television. MTUSA became Ireland's first music video show way back in 1984. It was presented by Vincent Handley and producer Conor McNally. And they were inspired by MTV, and they wanted to do something similar here in Ireland. Bill Hughes joined the show soon after. It ran for 3 seasons until 1987, when Vincent Handley died of AIDS. I sat down with Bill Hughes in his home and discussed that time.
Hello again, and here we are in New York, a very wet New York today, with another MTUSA just about recovered from last week's big street party. The police told us afterwards there were an extra 2 million people in the city for that party last week, and I think I believe it because they all sooner or later stepped on my toes.
I'm Bill Hughes, television producer, and recently retired.
Oh, you never retire. You'll keep going, no?
I'll keep going because there's still petrol in the tank. But I won't be in the cut and thrust of having to deal with commissioning editors and the broadcasters anymore.
It's Rewind. It's 1984. Bring me back, or bring us back to 1984, 40 years ago. What was Ireland like?
Ireland, at that time, it's literally like looking back at black and white. Ireland was in black and white. It wasn't in colour, the whole country. It was so dour. And, you know, everything was illegal. Everything. And this is Ireland still under the grip of the Catholic Church, still without divorce. It was still illegal to be gay in this country and didn't change till 93, imagine. So, yeah, 84 was a pretty dismal time. And also, AIDS had started to rear its ugly head and was coming slowly into the country, and everybody was paranoid. The cops at the time had a lot more power. They were doing a lot of entrapment of people, and they were breaking up parties just for the sake of breaking it up and let's go and hit a few queers. That's what their attitude was. It was terrible. But I suppose really, 84, you're still in the throes of the fallout from the Child Self murder. And the Child Self murder meant that the Gardaí got access to all the names and addresses of gays around the country by raiding various clubs. And so they would show up at work, places of work, for people like bank tellers or school teachers who happened to be gay. But they would show up and ask for the headmaster or the bank manager or whatever. And they'd say, we're here to discuss the homosexual murder of Charles Self, immediately outing the person.
And back then, people weren't out, or most gay men weren't out.
No, you couldn't be out. And it was still, like, it was forbidden for a gay to teach in a school. And Banks were very anti-gay as well. So all that happened was anybody that was feeling they were being outed just packed their bags and made their way to Dunleary or Dublin Airport and got the hell out of here. And they went to the furthest flung countries where they felt gays would be accepted. And the problem was they were coming from Ireland, they were quite naive, and they ran straight into AIDS.
So they ran straight into the AIDS epidemic. And I wanted to ask you about that because you made this brilliant documentary that's up there on the RTE player, Sex, Lies and Videotapes. And it really is a great watch. And it's about your friendship with radio and TV star Vincent Hanley. Bring us back to that time and bring us back to this amazing TV show, the first of its kind in Europe, MTUSA.
Vincent was the star of RTE2, Radio 2, as it was at the time. And he had, because he spent so much time in New York, he had seen the emergence of MTV. And he came back and discussed it with the TV producer, Connor McAnally. And they decided that together they could come up with a formula that would work on Irish television and bring videos to Irish television. So that would have been in 1983. And the show didn't eventually get on air until February 1984. But that was after Connor had to go to the record companies individually and negotiate with them on changing their attitude to putting videos on television. Because the record companies assumed that the videos were going to be profitable in themselves. They didn't understand that the videos were promotion for the albums and the tours and the singles. So that whole thinking hadn't changed. So Connor had to reinvent the wheel and eventually get MTUSA on board. And then Connor and Vincent asked me to join them as a producer. And so once I got in there, we had the best time.
And going to the USA, actually going out there, going out to New York, and I understood you travelled back and forth with actual videotapes. Fab Vinny, as he was called, which he made that nickname his own.
He did make that nickname his own, and he was really proud of it. He'd be on the radio, and one of the things that, one of his catchphrases was kissy kissy. And he would, when there were requests coming into the radio station, he would send kissy kissies out to people. So he'd get letters in and phone calls. Please, could you send a kissy kissy to Marie down in Tralee? But Vincent would, being Vincent, would make up names as well. And this one now, I'm sending a kissy kissy to Gobnut down in Hackball's Cross. And I believe this is your favourite song. And he'd play something vile. And he would literally be laughing on the floor. He was up for divilment all the time, but he was a visionary. And when MTUSA came on air, it was like Ireland went into colour. It was like it changed the way we looked at television.
And it was a huge hit. It was a must watch.
It was massive. Everybody watched it. Everybody's Sunday afternoons, the streets were clear because they weren't watching GA matches. They were watching MTUSA on the telly. And then after 25 years, Sony released a best of MTUSA, and it was a gorgeous box set of CDs and DVDs and everything. And they had it in HMV Grafton Street, and I went in just to see what the display was like because I was so, intrigued by this. And I'm standing there looking at it, and this young guy comes up to me and he says, "Are you Bill Hughes?" And I said, "I am, yeah." He said, "Were you the producer of MTUSA?" And I said, "I was, yeah." And he said, "That's my dad over there. He said to tell you that I was conceived on the couch while they were watching it and her parents were out."
Oh, wow. So there you go. You made Irish families bigger.
Yeah, in a funny way. The saddest thing about the HIV and the AIDS crisis in Ireland. HIV is not a crisis. It's AIDS that's the crisis. And when AIDS is as it used to be termed, full blown. But the biggest problem was that so many of the guys that came home to die or whose parents were contacted, that was the first time the parents knew that their son was gay.
That was the first time.
So they weren't just discovering that he was gay, they were discovering that he was dying of AIDS.
And there was no cure.
No cure. At that time, no cure. And now that has all changed. There's a magic pill. It came in 1995, combination therapy. And nobody and needs to die from that anymore.
Live a full life.
Oh, yeah, people are. Yeah, lots of my friends are just living normal lives.
And when we look back at that time, do you think we should have done it so differently that we shouldn't have victimised these poor young men? It was a tough time, and I know you've talked about it, and there's been that drama. It's a sin that, in a way, encouraged you to go off and talk about your own experience.
Listen, Henry, at that time, we were mistreating everybody. You know, the number of young women who fell pregnant ended up in those mother and baby homes, those dreadful... They were still in full swing in the 80s, you know? So that was happening to them, and all the young guys... The awful thing of AIDS was happening to them. And also the ostracization of being thrown out of your family. But still, this goes on to this day, you know, where young people come out to their parents and they come home from school or whatever and they discover all their belongings are out in a bag at the front of the door and don't come
in. Even now.
Even now. And that's why charities like Belong To are so important. For young people who have no refuge, nowhere to go, and they've just been thrown out because they're gay and because the parent has some crazy notion that this is a bad thing. My favourite thing of 84 was the reaction to the first MTUSA when the whole country went crazy and the whole country got to see Connor and Vincent's vision and got to see pop videos on television. That was just so magical because before, Ireland was in black and white, and MTUSA brought it into colour.
Bill Hughes, producer, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
A big thank you to producer Bill Hughes there.
Taking you back in time. The Rewind with Henry McKean. This is News Talk.
It's 1984. I'm Henry McKean. We're celebrating that year until the top of the hour. I sat down with pop culture expert David O'Callaghan from the Here and Back Again podcast.
The biggest movie of the year was Beverly Hills Cop, which obviously just recently had number four. Ghostbusters was released that year, the first one.
Two massive movies.
Absolutely massive movies. Indiana Jones, number two, The Temple of Doom was that year. A personal favourite of mine, Gremlins, who doesn't love a bit of Gizmo?
Has it got a name, Dad?
Yeah, Mogwai.
What?
Mogwai. I don't know, some Chinese word. I just call him Gizmo. He seems to like it.
Gremlins was that year. The Karate Kid, the first Karate Kid, which obviously is having a huge resurgence with Cobra Kai.
Wax on, wax off. Don't forget to breathe. Very important.
Things like Police Academy, but then also other kind of ones that weren't big hits at the time but became massive franchises were Nightmare on Elm Street was released that year. The Terminator, and then one that I personally kind of adore is The Neverending Story, which is always, I love the book, so the movie, the first one was brilliant, and they're now making a brand new series about it.
So in 1984, how old were you?
13.
So you were basically just starting out as a teenager. You must have just loved that time.
I was living the nerd dream. It was like people call it the geek year of 84. Like it was kind of insane when you think about what was being released. And we're talking like every 2 weeks one of these was opening. Like, and that for as a cinema goer at the time, you're just like, oh my god, you think you've seen the best thing you've ever seen, and then 2 weeks later, Ghostbusters opened, and then 2 weeks later, Gremlins opened.
And you were actually in the cinema watching them. You didn't have to wait for
it
to come out on VHS.
Yeah, on the bus, the 68 bus from Newcastle into either the Adelphi, Savoy, or Carlton were the three kind of choices that we usually went for. I don't have tattoos, and I've never gotten tattoos, but there's some moments in my cinematic kind of journey where I've nearly got tattoos, and... Believe it or not, Slimer, thank God I didn't go with it. When I was older, obviously, not at 13. But Slimer was in my... And obviously, don't forget the song. Ray Parker Jr.'s Ghostbusters song was everywhere. Gizmo was just... You know, so these kind of things, you kind of go, oh, that's for me, you know, I always think, one, thank God I was sensible. But two, at the time, I had a Slimer t-shirt that I wouldn't never take off. And it was the beginning of that merchandise kind of vibe. It was the first time really you could buy merchandise around these big IPs. And it's totally changed now. Like, you don't have a movie without merchandise. If you look around, whether it's my house or wherever I am, I have toys from back in the day. You can still buy t-shirts, and you know, and if you look back, retro is in now. So there's a reason why Ghostbusters is being remade and Gremlins has a new cartoon series, and because people love these, and it's all to do with you buying a Pop Funko or a mug or a t-shirt or even a big pillow of Gizmo's head. All these type of things, that's ultimately what, on top of making money on the movie, that's where companies, and don't forget, a lot of these studios run kind of parks, amusement parks, so they might have kind of Ghostbusters walking around, you know, doing things. And so it's a huge money spinner. So they are still making money off Ghostbusters, even though, yes, it's been remade films, but they're probably making more money from the original Ghostbusters because they can do Lego Echo 1 or Ecto 1 kind of Lego machines with the car and all that. So big money in merchandise and big money in retro right now, hence why you go to your local cinema, sure, what do you see on the screens? Nothing. As well as the new releases, it's all kind of old movies being reshown and people going back and bringing their kids and stuff.
So what else happened in 84?
Music-wise, our music in the cinema actually had a really strong year, because you had, in that one year, This is Spinal Tap, which is one of the funniest mockumentaries you'll ever see in your life, so you have to see that. Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense, which still rocks up every, like, 4 weeks in the Lighthouse or some cinema nearby. So that was released. And Prince's Purple Rain was released. So it was a really strong year for movies about music and involving music. And Prince actually won the Oscar that year for Purple Rain, the score, while, funny enough, Stevie Wonder, I Just Called to Say I Love You, Believe It or Not, was in a movie, The Woman in Red, and he won the Oscar for a song. Miami Vice, Murder, She Wrote, V, who doesn't love V, Airwolf for the absolute nerds, but Robin Hood, so they all started then, but for me, Robin Hood, Robin of Sherwood, as it was called on UTV at the time, or ITV, it was basically this guy, Richard Carpenter, who had created Dick Turpin, which everybody loved in 1979 to 82, and he was given a free rein to make a new show. So basically he decided he wanted to make a gritty version of Robin of Sherwood. I suppose you could argue it's Peaky Blinders back in the day, but Robin of Sherwood. Michael Praed played Robin, and the first two seasons are absolutely iconic for two reasons. One, it was like nothing we'd seen before. Dick Turpin was quite funny, whereas this was like, it was quite dark and moody, and the Merry Men weren't so merry, Ray Winston being one of them, so you can understand that. But Clannad also did the soundtrack, and this one, but like, they had done Harry's Game, but this one put them on the map, and people were like, what? Like, everybody knows The Hooded Man, and it was absolutely amazing. All the music, it will haunt your soul. It is so just, I don't want to say unclannily, because it fits so perfectly. I've never heard a score since that's fit a show perfectly, and for a TV show to have that as opposed to a movie, there's huge budgets behind a movie, but this was Clannad kind of pushing through and amazing.
And 1984, you mentioned Murder, She Wrote, hitting our screens, Jessica Fletcher, that was also massive. I still watch it sometimes. I was on a ferry.
Yeah.
I never know what happened because the ferry arrived.
Yeah.
But I was glued to the TV in my cabin.
Oh yeah, no, it is. All that kind of whole Columbo vibe. It's just, that was the big thing on TV, and you'd be, you know, trying to keep up with Jessica and how she's thinking and trying to figure out who did the murder. And it's just fantastic stuff. And it's still, they have, like, they'd show screenings. As far as I remember, there's a Murder, She Wrote sing-along. There's just all these versions, and it's, people in cinemas are showing like two episodes back to back. But yeah, Angela Lansbury, absolutely fantastic. I love that. So Knight Rider was a massive hit in 1983. So then, like most TV companies, you go, right, that's a hit. What we need is another vehicle of some sort that can talk and do stuff. So Airwolf was born, and Airwolf was a helicopter, and it was one of these, the man behind the lines trying to save it. That was kind of a success for about two seasons. So then they said, well, we need another vehicle, because this was the trend. So what did they go with? Street Hawk. And for absolutely down the rabbit hole, Street Hawk, I love Street Hawk, which was a motorbike doing the exact same thing.
So they knew that people wanted vehicles, they wanted robots, that they wanted fast action.
Yeah, and then once the Street Hawks of this world and Airwolves kind of didn't work, they moved on to the next thing.
Well, Dave O'Callaghan, thank you so much for joining the Rewind 84.
Good times.
And that's it for the Rewind 1984. A big thanks to all my guests. I'm Henry McKean. Until the next time, thank you for listening.